I've got to know this gentleman for a very short time this evening. I have heard him talk before, and he has a good message for all of us. He's been sober in San Jose for 20 years, and been here in San Jose for 20 years and sober about 8. And with that, I'm just going to let it roll with Barry from San Jose.
I got a new name. My name's Bernie, and I'm an alcoholic. you can't help but give a good pitch in a room like this with so much enthusiasm and so much love and so much happiness evident all around you. You feel it. I haven't been here now in quite a while, and it's impossible not to react to it. I have a daughter that's on the program about 2 years. I have a son that ought to be, and I have another one who won't even discuss Alcoholics Anonymous or anything related to it, and I don't know what he is. And they're all about the age of some of you people here. And as I look around the room, there are a lot of you that I know. And I was driving over, and I was thinking, what do you really say to a group of young people, you know, that are half my age? I've just become a senior citizen this month. I'm 60, and I'm near retirement. I figure, what do I have to offer? What can I say? And so the thought came, tell them how you stayed sober, you know? What made the program click? And it was a room like this in San Francisco, at a place called the Tenderloin, that I walked in and I had that reaction. I felt accepted. I felt that I could be myself. I could dress like I wanted. I could say what I wanted to do. I could be quiet if I wished. In other words, I was totally accepted. Nobody even wanted to know anything about me except what was my name. And then they said, keep coming back. And then when the fellow was chairing the meeting, I was right in tune with him, not with his story, but in tune with him, and I didn't know why. And I figured, what is it about, you know, when I was going home, driving back, I lived here then, as I do now, and I worked up there. I figured, what is it? What touched me? And I didn't understand till later on, but I finally came to the realization that I was getting in touch with his emotions. I identified his rage and his anger. I was familiar with his frustration. And all of those things that had welled up in me and been kept inside me for so many years is what I heard at that meeting. And it just blew me away. And I decided I'm coming back next week. And I did. And I have never taken a drink, luckily, since that first meeting. And I was willing to listen, because when I come in through these doors, I was beat. Every part of me was down. I had tried everything to stop drinking, and nothing worked. So I was willing to listen. And I think that was the first breakthrough. When I had a 502 about 5 years before I got to AA, when I was in the drunk tank that night, I know now that I admitted to my innermost self I was an alcoholic. And that was my first step towards sobriety. I now know. And so for 5 years, I carried that around inside of me. You're an alcoholic and you really can't drink. But it took that long for me to want to do something about it. And the second thing I did, when I come into the meeting, after the second or third meeting, I got up and I said, my name's Bernie and I'm an alcoholic. And I accepted that. There was no fight left. It was all gone. I wasn't interested in questioning whether I was, or questioning what the definition was, or what people on the outside said, or what people on the inside said. I knew I could not drink. I knew I had lost the ability to control that drinking. I heard it said here somewhere by someone. Everything that I know, I have picked up from others. There are no bad meetings for me. Every meeting, if I listen close enough, I'll pick up something. And so... admittance and acceptance were the first two steps that I took towards sobriety. And the third one was surrendering. And I didn't surrender right away. A person like me, who took all this time to get to this program, won't give up easy. Even though my ears were open, and even though I was willing to listen to others, I wasn't necessarily giving it all up inside me. But I surrendered, and I think I surrendered around the third step, and I don't know when it was, maybe 6 months or 9 months after being in the program and agreeing to do what people told me. They said, go to a lot of meetings and get a sponsor, which I didn't do right away, but I did go to a lot of meetings, and get into the steps, which I also didn't do. But I go to step meetings, or I go to big book meetings, usually right here in Camel, and I listen. And I kept listening to what others had to say, you know, and it began to rub off. And then I got into reading some of the books, like the Big Book and As Bill Sees It and the History of AA. I found myself wanting to know more about this program. See, all the time I knew I had intelligence. I knew the people that I listened to at meetings had intelligence. I knew they were sober. And something inside me said, if you're willing to accept what you hear and to just do it like they say, a day at a time, you know, you'll never take another drink. And I had hope and I believed it. And I never questioned that I could be a success in this program. I just didn't want to do that. And I just kept pushing and going ahead without very much effort, just going to meetings and being willing to listen to others. And then when I read what Bill W. had to say, a lot of stuff began to make sense to me. I noticed through his writings, like in As Bill Sees It, he makes reference time after time to charting a course, like a middle lane or a middle avenue, or sail down in a channel, take the center course. And he advises what the message I get from the different things that he proposes. He gives us balance, and he shows something on this hand and something on that hand. He said, like a lot of things make reference to, avoid the extremes and avoid the excesses. Stay in the middle. And this was good for me because I could stay out or stay away from, you know. He mentions pride, and he said pride, fool's gold coin of pride and recklessness cause a lot of us problems. And I picked that up right away, and I figured, yeah, that's been a cause of a lot of my problems. He also mentioned somewhere, and as Bill sees it, the fact that if we're asked to do something that's reasonable, or if we know that something's reasonable and we don't do it, we pay a penalty for it. We pay some kind of a cost or some kind of a price. He also says on the opposite side, if we assume a perfection that we don't have, or a virtue, or whatever you want to call it, if we assume that and we don't have it, we pay a price for doing that. And he says somewhere in between is where our spiritual growth will come. And he says that's where we will learn to practice humility. So these simple, basic things that I'm sure I've heard a dozen times throughout my life are the things I picked up, you know? I heard a guy who's since passed away, his name was Mark. I heard Mark at a meeting one time say, this is a program of recovery and a program of discovery. And it just, you know, it was just like a bulb going on. I thought, oh my God, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Recovery, we come in here, we start putting our act together, our minds clear up, our health is restored if it was impaired. And then we begin to find out who we are, you know. And I was 51 when I came to this program. And I learned after being here for a while, I didn't know a goddamn thing about myself. I didn't know what made me tick. I didn't know why I did the things that I did. I didn't know why I avoided the things that I avoided. All I knew was that most of my life I picked out images or persons, and I wanted to be like that. And I had pursued that kind of a course. And I usually picked out people who were like myself. They were losers. I heard another man say that you know, he was a guaranteed loser and a successful failure when he got to this program. And I love the analogy, you know, and I figure that's it. You know, when I heard somebody say you come in here to surrender so you can win, I figured, you know, how does, you know, it didn't make sense. And I started thinking about it. And that's the way I learned. I learned from what other people had to say. Probably the biggest thing that ever, two things that stick out in my mind right now. I was in Hawthorne. I travel a lot. I've been in sales for a good many years, and from time to time I'm on the road a lot. And I was at a meeting in Hawthorne, and I remember sitting there because I wanted to go to a meeting, and that's about as far as my interest extended itself. And I heard this black man get up, and he said, you know, this program is very simple. We got to grow or go. And it was just like a bolt of lightning, you know, one of those revelations where I suddenly realized that's what it's all about. You come in here, and you go to meetings like I did, then I can stay sober. And I knew I could stay sober by just going to meetings. But I knew there was something else. There was another depth. There was another dimension to this program. Because I saw it in your eyes. I saw it in your face. I saw the changes that occurred in you. Even if I don't know your name, you know, seeing people at meetings, and I'm sure it's occurred with you, you notice the difference in them. After a month, after 6 months, after a year, after several years, they're changed. Something occurs. They might know it, but we know it because we're at the meeting. And that's what made, when I realized that, I figured I have to do something else. And what do I have to do? And then I heard somebody say, you know, get rid of your resentments. And I realized that I carried a lot around. And I heard somebody at a meeting right over here in Campbell, was sharing a meeting. It was a discussion meeting. And she said, when I came to realize that I would have been a son of a bitch, regardless of who my parents were, she said, my resentment against my parents went away. And I had that kind of a resentment. And I thought, isn't that, there it is. And that's the answer. And the resentment did go away. So it's statements like that and simple things and being willing to accept the program for what it is and not try to read into it and trying to keep it as simple as I can that has helped me to maintain my sobriety. Thank you.
Okay, I would like to apologize to Barry and thank Bernie again for being our 10-minute speaker. Okay, we're going to take a short 5-minute break, and if you would like to pick up... Right. Okay, I'd like to introduce the main speaker for this evening. The lady I know is from San Jose, and I also know that she's been sober for about 10 years, which is a hell of an accomplishment, I think. I'm enjoying to hear her story. I would like to give you Sheila M. from San Jose.
Now we all hope I'm worthy of that, right? Anyhow, I'm Sheila, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was deciding whether I should explain I'm Sheila J and Sheila M, but it doesn't make any difference. It's neither here nor there. let's see, what it used to be like and what happened and all that good stuff. Well, my first 7 years on Earth were really nice. They really were. I had a nice mama. And my father was a drunk, but he got thrown out when I was really young. And, he is a drunk, so what could you do, you know? The axe came flying through the window once too often. My mother said she'd had it. And I'm serious when I say an axe. So I was raised in a very uproarious childhood. You know, it was just like everybody was very outspoken. Like a lot of people that know me, they say, God, you're so outspoken. And the thing is, I come by that naturally because where I lived, if you didn't say something, you got creamed. And that's just the way it was, you know. So then my mother proceeded to die. She had TB, and she took about 3 years to die, which was a very traumatic thing for a little kid and all that. And... when she died, now while she was a strong woman, and when she, even though she was laying in her bed dying for 3 years of TB, she ruled the roost. I mean, she was laying helpless in her bed, but the rest of the kids, and I have older brothers and sisters, they did everything that she wanted them to do when they were supposed to do it. So life was still good even though she was in bed. And I think I learned to be reliable when I was little because I used to have to come back at a certain time. Like I'd go out to play, this is when I was 5, 6, and 7 years old, I could go out to play if I would be back at a specific time because she could not get up and run after me, you know. So that taught me reliability. So to this day, I am reliable. One good thing. So then she died and oh, the shit hit the fan, let me tell you, because I was like Cinderella and until she died and then it really hit the fan. It was 10 years of sheer agony and I don't even want to go into it. It was just the shits, let me tell you. So when I was 17, I left home and I lived with my brothers and sisters in orphanage and foster home and all that good stuff. And when I was 17, I left home and... That's when it all began. I it was really a rant, horrible. But anyhow, I started going with this one guy. And back in the Dark Ages, which is where I come from, the Dark Ages, one did not hanky and panky like one does today with immunity. I mean, maybe you did, but I think you got caught and got pregnant and had to get married. I don't know. But anyhow... So the first guy I went with, and this is part of my ridiculous story, but the first guy I went with, you know, we necked and everything, we petted, and boy, it was good, but, you know, I couldn't screw him because we just didn't do that. And so, because what if you get pregnant, and then what do you do, and you know, all this horrible stuff. And I didn't want to have any kids because I already raised a bunch of kids. That's part of my story of when I was, you know, 10 to 17. It was my sisters kept having kids, and every time one of them would have a kid, my workload would increase. And that's just the way it was. And every time I'd see them with a big belly, I just want to kill them. You know, I just want to sock it. And that's it. So my feelings about motherhood and wifehood, you know, with what with axes coming through the window and people getting the shit beat out of them a lot, I didn't think that that was a very good deal in life, was to get married and have babies. And so I dropped that guy because, you know, I was necking and petting with him, and boy, it was good. And God, you know, I just thought, I can't do this. And so I dropped his rear end, and I started going with his best friend. Well, oh, plus this first guy was stupid. I forgot to tell you that. And I didn't want to be with a stupid person. I'm so intelligent. So then I went with this other guy, and, well, hell, after you've petted with one guy, it feels so good you just fall into it quicker, right, the second time around. So I didn't really want to get married and have all these babies, but, you know, there it was, and I really wanted to get laid is what it was, and right, and I gotta have a drink. So anyhow, so I married this guy. Oh, because we were necking, and I thought, oh my God, and he wants to get married. See, if you don't go to bed with people, they do want to get married. That's what happens. There's big incentive there. So. So anyhow, so we got married, and my goodness, I hate to tell you, we were married a whole month before we ever did anything. It was a mess, and I don't even want to go into that. We couldn't figure it out. You think that's bad? He was 25 and I was 18. Anyway, that's the dark ages, folks. So anyhow, well, I didn't really like this guy, I have to say, you know, and I was 17, well, I was 17, you know, while I went with him, and I was 18. As soon as I was 18, you know, we got married, and at first they had no record of my birth, and then I found out they even told me my wrong birthday as I was growing up. That's how important I was in life, you know. And so I found out when I was born, celebrating the wrong day and everything. But anyhow, things progressed, and we were married a couple of years, and then I had this horrible dream. I was raised a Catholic, and you know, not to put the Catholics down, all this crap that I'm going to say is my own crap. It's not the Catholic crap, okay? It's my crap. Well, you know, you draw your own decision. So anyhow, and I had this dream. I'm always having these dreams, these visions, you know, a vision for you, right? Anyhow, I had this dream, and in this dream I saw God, or whoever, one of his head people there, and one of his head honchos. It was somebody with a beard and everything. And so everybody is trucking along, feeling, you know, in this dream, and I'm trucking along with the crowd, and all of a sudden this guy in the white robe goes, no, and he points in this other direction. And I had to call alone. And I'm going, oh, God, I'm going to hell. Because I didn't get married in the church because I didn't really, really want to do this, you see. So everybody at work convinced me, you should get married in the church, Sheila. And so I went and got married in the church. And you might want to know, well, what the hell has this got to do with anything? Because I always was trying to do the right thing if I had to. It was always if I had to. You know, if you really got me pushed to shove and everything. And the Catholic Church was very important in my whole life. So we went to the altar and, you know, did all this good stuff. And I can remember, this is how I got married, folks, and this is no lie. I didn't like the guy. I'm already married to him for 3 years, right? And I haven't had, I had a drink when I was 17, I had a drink when I was 18, I got drunk both times, I had a drink and a half drunk for 2 days in a blackout, but you know, that's all that I did, 17 and 18, a year apart, same thing, puke my guts out. So in all this time, I'm doing all this sober, I want you to know. So we go to the church, and I am crying like a son of a bee. The priest keeps asking, "Do you take this man," or whatever they ask, and I am crying. And he's getting real pissed, you know, and he says, "Do you take this man?" And he already said he did, whatever. And I'm crying and crying. I just feel like I'm dying, right? Finally, he gets real mad, and they go, and this, my friend says, "Look at that. She's so happy she can't stop crying. She's so thrilled." And I'm going, "God, I'm wondering how to escape." So finally, I say, "Yeah." And we get home, and he says to me, "I finally have you now. You'll never leave me." Okay? So we trucked on for another 10 years. We had a baby, and I got drunk to have this baby. Now, we were doing sex all right. We finally figured it out. We'd been doing that for 3 years, and which shows we're not totally hopeless. But I had talked to the priest, and he says, "You have got to have a kid." He says, "You cannot." I just, "But I don't want to have any kids." See, I'd already had all these kids. I was sick of kids. I did the midnight routine. I did the dirty diapers. I did that crap. I've been taking care of houses since I was about 11 years old, and I was sick of it. He says, "You, if you're old enough to be married," and that means to be hanky-in and panky-in, "then you're old enough to have a kid." So that's when I did my first alcoholic drinking. I went and got a bottle of, really, give me a bottle. Well, because we were doing the rhythm method. For you uninitiated out there, the rhythm method is this. It's for the girl. When you don't want it, that's when you can have it. And when you want it, that's when you can't have it. That is the rhythm method. So I decided, okay, so I am going to get pregnant. That's the truth, because you, when you're fertile is when you want it, and when you're not fertile is when you, you know, you don't care that much when you're young. But anyhow, so then, well, this is very important. It really is. It's not slimy. This is important. the mind, you know, the mind, you know, we're so out of control and we don't even know what the hell's going on in our life. So anyhow, I got my bottle of booze, and I, because I knew it was dangerous, which means I was going to get pregnant. So I told him, I says, "You get it in me, and I'll figure out how to get it out." And that's how I got pregnant. I mean, that was the wonderful motherhood coming about, you know. Now, isn't that incredible? What a disgusting way to have to get pregnant. But that's what we did. And so we had 4 pregnancies and 3 kids, and, you know, and then about 6 years later, I discovered booze, which was really wonderful because, you know, it wasn't too bad, you know, when you're drunk all the time. And from the first month that I drank, I just got it on. You know, it's like I just felt good. And about 1 month later, I started drinking in the morning because that's when I wanted it. That way I didn't kill everybody. I didn't kill my kids. I didn't kill my husband. I was fairly pleasant. And I can remember when I'd been drinking for about 2 or 3 months that I remember looking at my wine glass. And I said, "Oh, my God, anything that good has got to be that bad." I knew that from the Catholic Church, you see. I knew that it was so good, it was so bad. And I can remember looking at that glass and saying, "One day, but not today." You know, and that was, and I knew at some time I would have to face that. But it was always not today. I never drank decently. I never drank sociably. I never drank okay. Whenever I drank, now I could maintain, I wasn't falling on my face constantly, but I never knew. You know, I just never knew what in the hell I would do next. And so the few times that I would socially drink, I would get home quickly because it was not safe for me to be out drinking because I just never knew what was going to happen. And I just wanted to be drinking at home by myself. And like right from the gate, I would have drinks at lunchtime, at my job. People would bring in booze. I was the group leader. I'd pour the booze, for heaven's sakes, you know, right on the assembly line. So we had a lot of fun, and I maintained that marriage with him for the 7 more years. We were married 13 years. And then one day I went to confession to confess my many sins and to tell him that I had a drinking problem. And I knew about AA from the time I was 7 years old because I used to eavesdrop all the time. And my father was a drunk, and so they were talking about him going to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a new outfit at the time. And my mother said, "Oh, there she is, getting this axe through the window and a rear end whipped all the time." And she says, "Oh, no, I don't want him to associate with all those lowlifes, you know." And, I mean, he really, really bad, you know. And I can remember just being in the hall and going, "Oh, yes, he should go," you know, because somehow I wanted us all to be human. And that's what I always wanted all my life, was for us all to be human somehow. Well, we never made it. But then I went to confess and tell him all my bad stuff again, and he says, what about how many kids do you have? Now, I hadn't been to church for a while, and I thought I could get some help with my drinking. And I said a drinking problem, not as a falling down drunk, you know, but I said drinking problem, because when you're going into confession, you don't want to say, "Well, I'm a sleazo drunk," you know. So, plus, you don't even want to say that to yourself. You have a little drinking problem. So he was just interested in how many kids I had and that I should have more and all that other good stuff. And I thought, oh, my God, see, I had these kids, and my big goal in life was to raise them so that I could die in peace. That was my goal because, see, my mother died, my father wasn't around, and it was the shits. So if I'm going to have these 3 kids, the least I can do is get them to a certain age and then die in peace. And he didn't seem to understand, if I kept having children, how could I ever die in peace, right? I calculated it out. By obeying the law of that whatever, I'd have 14 kids. And I just didn't want 14 kids. I didn't really want any, you know. I have 3 wonderful kids. They really are neat kids. But, you know, it just never was my planning. And I guess the reason I'm bringing all this out is we just careen along in life and we keep doing. We get into this relationship and we go over there. And we think, God, if we had any brain cells, we'd do better. But the point is that, you know, you don't have that many choices in your head. You think, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. If I don't do that, the world comes to an end. I used to think they eject you off the face of the earth or something. It's like, you know, I think, well, could you face prison? Yeah, I could face prison, but I don't think I could face that. And I never could figure out exactly what that was, except one day I figured out that I guess I thought they ejected you somewhere. Not really, but somehow it was like a fate worse than going to hell. And then after a couple of years, so I told my husband goodbye, and because I used to think of him being, you know, when he'd be 5 minutes late from work, I would be sitting there so happy, and I'd think, shit, he finally had an accident, and I would hope that he would be dead. I know you people out there have thought the same thing. Then I used to feel guilty, and I'd say, oh, God, instead of him, just do one of us. It's okay if it's me. I don't care. Just do one of us, but let us get out of this horrible situation. And you might say, what did your husband do that was so horrible? I have to tell you, nothing. He didn't do anything horrible. I mean, he didn't beat me. He didn't do anything. I just didn't like him, you know? What can I say? You know, he used to tell me, you're crazy. I'd say, I know. And I told him I had to leave, and he says, you're crazy. And, you know, I had to agree with him because my whole family is nuts. I have a sister that has had umpty-ump shock treatments, and she's never been okay. I have a brother that's a major criminal. I have 2 other ones that have not been caught with the net, but there is no one walking around in that, and then I'm the drunk, right? And there's no one in that family that's walking around okay. I mean, they just are not. So when he would tell me, and he had this nice family, they had a mother, they had a father, they had some kids, and they had a house, and they had inside plumbing and stuff like that, you know, just like regular human beings. So I always thought that his family was okay and he was okay, and I was not okay. So every time it came up that you're nuts, I agreed. And then I'd say, but I can't help it. I still got to leave. So I finally left. And then I sat in front of my fireplace with my little glass of wine, and I had a nicer home than I'd ever had. My three kids, I really do love my kids, even though they were born probably not under what people would call ideal situation, where you're just dying to have kids. I've got three beautiful kids, and I was drunk as hell, and I had a live-in babysitter that used to do all my housework and fix my hair, and just what I always wanted. And I sat crying in front of my fireplace with my little glass of wine, and I said, oh God, I was always calling on God for everything, and I said, oh God, I know what I need. I need a good man. That's what I need. And I started busting a gut. I'm all by myself, right? And I started busting a gut laughing. I said, you big asshole. What good man would want anything to do with you? And I really had to look at that. And I said, that's right. Not only that, he probably wouldn't want me to drink. Forget it. Forget that, God. I don't want it. I drink some more. Then I try to kill myself. I took a bunch of pills and I took a bunch of wine, and all I did was wake up with the tunnel vision and crippled for about 5 hours. And during this horrible deal, I couldn't believe I woke up, because I didn't call the whatever squad or anything. I just thought, well, you just die in peace finally. The kids will be better off without you. And when I woke up, all I could think of was, my God, it's going to be hard to get a bottle of wine when you can't see, and I'll have to get a wheelchair, and I wonder how long that takes. And that's all I could think about. But I wasn't nuts, you know? I wasn't nuts. I just thought of the next drink and how hard it was going to be. To what streets did I have to go across? How long would it take to get a wheelchair? And my vision, you know? And, well, it'd probably kill me anyhow, but it'd be okay. And that's where I was at, folks. And then right after that, I had this, that moment of clarity, I guess the book calls it, a moment of clarity. And in that little moment of clarity, the little voice or whatever, you might think it's hallucination, but it was like, Sheila, you have to do something this lifetime. Otherwise, you will go through all the agony and all the crisis and everything to get to this point again where you might make a decision. This horrified me. I mean, I thought, my God, I've already lived a life of hell. And I have to say, my drinking was not as bad as my childhood. I mean, you know, it just really wasn't quite as bad. And I thought, I'm going to have to go through all this to get to the point where I can make a decision. And I counted it as biting the bullet, because by now I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. A few friends had dared to tell me about it, as though I might need it, right? Well, I quickly got rid of those people, I can tell you. So that didn't stop me from drinking. I quickly went and got another bottle as soon as my vision cleared up. And I drank for about another 6 months. And then my ex-husband, God bless him, who is a good person. He really doesn't do anything wrong. I have to say this. You know, he's a good person. I just don't like him. So I go, he says, I'm 5 times the drunk that he is, by the way, because he started drinking when I told him I was leaving. And so what happened was he got a couple tickets, though, because he wasn't at home drunk like I was at home drunk. I used to just fall on the floor and kids would walk over my face. And, you know, what the hell? You know, they didn't have a vote. I didn't have a boyfriend. I didn't have anybody doing anything to me. I had a salesperson's job where you show up once in a while, rearrange your desk, sell a house, do something, and you can stay employed, you know. So, you know, there wasn't anybody getting on my case. And he had just started to be a drunk. So he got some tickets from where he worked, and so he went to AA. And he came over one day, and he says, Sheila, he says, you really ought to go to an AA meeting with me. And I says, yeah. I says, they got any girl drunks there? And he says, oh, yeah. He says, about a third. And I thought, oh, God, that's good, because I didn't know they had girl drunks. Now, that's hard to imagine, but what the hell, you know, I didn't know. And so I says, yeah, what do they look like? And he says, they look a hell of a lot better than you. So so I proceeded to go to the AA meeting. And, you know, it was in a wonderful Skid Row place down in Pasadena, the infamous 202 Club, which was off-bounds to all halfway house women, and off-bounds, and it was infamous, and everybody said it was terrible sobriety, it was just horrible, and nobody could get drunk there, and they're just all slobs. And there was about a fourth pure addicts and a fourth pure alkies, and about half and half, you know. So it was a really nice mixture. And they were very kind to me, and I can never forget how kind they just all gathered around me. I was the new turkey, right? And they all gathered around me and said, oh, that I didn't look too bad. I had a wig on, you know, and said good stuff to me and to keep coming back. And I think they said something about coming to a meeting every day, but I thought, my God, they must be nuts. I don't have time for this. So I proceeded to go to one meeting every week. And then I think I got drunk in between. I don't know. It's all a big blur. But then I proceeded to just stay away entirely, and I stayed drunk for another 6 months. And then, being as I wasn't dying or anything else, and it was getting really horrible, because even from three meetings, you know, they talk about the gut full of AA, and or the mind full of AA and the gut full of booze. So I can remember being drunk as can be and trying to tell people how wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous was. Just drunk, you know? And luckily, I didn't know too many people in that town, so because I was a hermit by the time I got the program. And then I finally came into the program with the idea, at the same place, with the idea that come hell or high water, I will stay sober. I will do whatever those drunks tell me to do, no matter what it is, because by God, if anybody can do anything, I can do it. And I've always had that attitude, that if you can do it, if I want to do it, I'll do it. And that's it. Well, let me tell you, that's what it took. Now, they said, hey, Turkey, you got to make a 180-degree turn. And so what they said was, if you don't have a job, you have to get a job. And so I thought, well, if you have a job, then you get to quit your job. Because wet, wet, wet. Because there was a guy there that had 7 years of sobriety and he never worked. And I thought, well, on the one hand, poor slob, he could never work. But on the other hand, lucky slob, he never has to, you know. And I came in, and I was on welfare. So they said, you have to get a job. So I called up the welfare department. I says, I don't need you anymore. And they says, well, do you have a job? I says, no, but I can get a job. And they says, well, we have to send you one more check. And boy, was I glad, because, see, it wasn't my fault if they had to send me a check, right? I was doing the program. They told me to get a job. I was doing the program. So I gave my kitties to my ex-husband. I says, here, you watch these guys for a while, because I don't think that I can stay sober and go to meetings and go to work and not kill these kids all at the same time. So he was angry as usual. He's always angry at me. I don't know why, but he always is. So he watched them, and he took care of them for about 4 or 5 months. And what happened was I got this job, and I ran everybody off that worked in that place. There used to be three people working there. And when I came in, they all quit within about a week or two. And I did the whole thing myself, which was wonderful. It was a nothing job, and which is about what I had to give is nothing. But it was, you know, like tailor-made. I went to 13 meetings a week, and I tell you, no matter what anybody said, I did it. They told me, Sheila, you are one of the worst we have ever seen. I mean, can you imagine at the Skid Row place, they told me that I was one of the worst. And I thought, God, if anybody knows about drunks, these people know about drunks, and I'm one of the worst. So I says, I better do. And that's just what I needed to hear. You know, it's just what I needed to hear. So they said, go to meetings. So, and they said, get a job. And so I worked 60 hours a week at this job because nobody else was there. So I had the whole place to myself, which was wonderful. I went to 13 meetings a week that were hour and a half meetings. I was on the phone. I did my 10-hour job in 6 hours a day, and I had several other lines there, and I was all by myself. So I used to be on the phone 4 hours a day. Plus, I had people stopping by because it was near the Skid Row Alano. It wasn't even an Alano Club. It was just an AA place. It wasn't an Alano Club. And I had people stopping by to bring me lunch and that type of thing. That's what it took for me to get sober. So when people go in an hour a night, work a step or something like that, I just think, God, maybe they didn't suffer like I suffered. I don't know. You know, I really don't know, because very few people had to go through that much, I don't think. You know, I just think my brain was so wet and I was such a mess that that's just what I had to do. The first people, I asked three people to sponsor me because I was following instructions. You know what they told me? No. And they didn't give a reason. They just said no and quickly walked, you know. They did not want what I had. And I knew it, but it was okay. Then this one lady said yes. She says, yes, I was oh so thrilled. She says, but I'm in Al-Anon. I says, I don't care. I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I thought it was the Child Molesting Society, but what did I care? I really did. I said, they probably molest children. They have something for everybody here. I thought, at least I won't look so bad to her, you know. And I talked to her a few times. I thought she was crazier than I was, so that was the end of that. But at least she did say yes. You got to give her that. You know, she thought she'd give it a go. And then after a while, I asked people, I says, well, when can I do something else? You know, and they used to go to the same meeting place every night. And they say, Sheila, 13 times a week, they says, Sheila, why don't you go somewhere else once in a while? That didn't bother me. I said, I like it here. And the reason I said I like it here is because I had a little car that I traded my television set for, because I had no phone and no car when I got to this program. Poverty is one of the other reasons I got to this program, because I don't do poverty good. Maybe I don't think anybody does poverty good, but I really hate poverty. And by the time I was on welfare for 8 months, so by that time I was really poor. Like everything was worn out and broken down, including me. And so anyhow, I had a map and I had a car, but I could never figure out where another meeting was. I mean, I had the schedule, you know, little schedule, little map, little car, but I could never figure out where it was. Because there wasn't anything going on upstairs. And even sometimes when I'd be going to the same meeting 13 times a week, I would get lost. I would literally get lost if I didn't make the left, right, left turn. I would be lost. And I'd go, God, I don't believe this. I'm lost again. And I'd have to drive around and around. The point of all that is that I don't care who you are, what's going on. If you want sobriety, you can stay sober. It just doesn't make any difference. It all starts up here. It just all starts up here. And there is something good about being a low-bottom drunk, and I guess that's what I am, is a low-bottom drunk from my own description, is that you really are grateful. It's like you're sober and anything else is a bonus. Because I really liken it to people being in a wheelchair. If you have somebody in a wheelchair and you say, hey, we got some therapy for you to do. And if you do this therapy, in a couple of months we'll have you walking. Now you're going to have to do the therapy for the rest of your life, but you will get to walk. Now, if you don't do the therapy, you're not just going to have your legs crippled, but pretty soon an arm's going to go, and then another arm's going to go, and then the head's going to go. Because that's the disease that you got. Now, if you talk to somebody like that, they would probably say, where's the therapy held? Lead me to it. So to me, this is the same thing. If you want it, we got it. If you don't want to do it, then sorry, I guess you'll have to stay drunk, you know, until it becomes desirable. In the Skid Row place, there was a lot of tough love, which is exactly what I needed. If you had the audacity to not have written the fourth step and done the fifth step, and you had the audacity to complain about anything in your life, they would literally shout up from wherever, because they used to have one of these things too, and they'd say, did you do the fourth step? And if you said, yeah, maybe you lied, maybe you didn't. Did you do the fifth step? And if you did, well, then they would talk to you, and they might even have a little sympathy, and they might even want to help you a little. But if you didn't do the fourth and the fifth step, Charlie, of course you're miserable and sick. What do you expect? You see? So they told me that I had resentments. And I said, me? I don't hate anybody. And they said, you do, Sheila. And I said, no, not me. And they said, you go home. They said, you get your big chief tablet and your pencil, and you turn to page 64 and 65 of the big book, and you do it just like columns, just like what they have there. And then you come back and tell us about it. So I went home because I wanted to stay sober, and I got my big chief tablet out, and I looked at the little columns, and I said, I don't hate anybody. And I said, oh, I guess I hate the church. Put that down. What it did and what it affected. And I said, well, I must have hated that husband. Otherwise, I wouldn't have dumped his rear end, right? So I put him. It flowed like diarrhea. That's the only thing I could say. It was incredible. By the time I got to the end of the list, and I hated my father for being a drunk because I should have been a lawyer. And, you know, I'm a real estate agent. And when I got through with that inventory, I looked at it and I said, you know, you are so full of crap and so ridiculous, et cetera, and other various things. Because, you know, Sheila, if you had the silver spoon in your mouth, there is no way that you would go to school for all those years to be anything, because you are a flash in the pan. That is your style. That has always been your style. Now, you could handle 8 easy lessons for real estate. That you could handle. But you're not going to go to school and learn something. That's not what you do. So I really saw that that was all ridiculous. I went to the meeting, and I said, well, I have done my 4th step. Aha. And they said, so who are you going to share it with? And I said, not any of you turkeys. Because if you get drunk, then you are going to blab it, and then everybody's going to know all about me. Now, what I'm going to do, and I said it right from a little podium like this, nice little group there, knew me well, been going there for about 3 months. I says, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get, was right on Skid Row, very well located. I says, I will go get a drunk from out here, put him in my little car, and promise him if he'll listen to me, I'll give him a bottle of wine. You got that? That's 3 months, 13 meetings a week. I was serious. They all laughed. And I said, you know, I think you don't have the idea of this whole program here. So... So I thought I'd better go home and read a little bit. And so I went home, and I thought, you know, the way they laughed, you're not doing this thing right. You got to get in a little insight, a little flash of intuition again. This is, you got to get the idea of the program and get in the spirit of the thing, not the mechanics. You see, I started to do the AA program like I did the Catholic Church. Get the mechanics down right. Don't have a sin that's a mortal sin. You will burn forever. A few venial sins, not too bad. You can pay that debt off. And with these steps, it was share with God and another human being. A drunk's a human being, right? See, and I was doing it technically instead of spiritually, getting the spirit of the thing. So I decided to go get someone. Well, I'll tell you what I did. I shared most of it at group level. And I shared the rest of it with another human being that was conscious. You know, she was conscious, she was in the program, and she gave me some of her time. And I'll tell you, that was when I did that step, because the first time I did the steps, it took me 2 minutes, do all of them 2 minutes, because I'm good. When I did that, I really saw, I always had doubts about the second step, you know, return us to sanity. I said, I'm not nuts, I'm just a drunk. When I listened to all you people talking about your stories, I knew you were nuts. Hell, there was no doubt about it that you were nuts. But not me. I'm just a little drunky poo, that's all. When I did that inventory and saw that, I said, you are a bona fide nut. You really belong here. There is no difference between you and them. You're all nuts. But it's okay. So that was where I really saw that I really belonged here this whole lifetime. You know, people say, my God, it means you can't drink forever. And, you know, we say a day at a time, but I knew from the gate that they didn't mean that day at a time. They meant this lifetime. So when people say, we can't drink forever. I say no, just this lifetime. Maybe next time if you learn your lesson, you can drink socially. Who the hell? I mean, who the hell would ever want to drink socially? I wouldn't want to drink socially. Well, you know, they don't get anything out of it. Why waste the calories? You know, have a piece of chocolate cake. At least you're getting something out of it. Hot fudge sundae, something. So forget that. So that's over. I have had so many incredible experiences in this program that my drunkalogue pales by comparison. And I've had some fun stuff being drunk. I mean, I went to jail once. That was fun. I was drunk the whole time. It's not so bad if you're drunk the whole time. I went to the nut house where I talked my way out of a ticket and convinced the cops that I'd hit a parked car and left the scene of an accident, was pouring myself a drink when I got home. And I had just been in jail 3 months earlier, so I convinced them that I was nuts. They took me to 3 psychiatrists, and they all said, yeah, she's nuts, and they threw me in the nut house. And my thing there that really scared me for an instance was there they give you the TB, they give you a TB, whatchamacallit, and diabetes, whatchamacallit, and everything. And so they determined that I had diabetes. And, you know, there I am in the nut house, and the only thing I could come up with is, Jesus Christ, I'll have to give up wine and start drinking scotch. That was all I came up with. Then when we did this TB thing, it was really funny. It was like out of one of those B movies. You have your little surgical gown on. It's flapping in the back, you know, with the breeze. They have all the boys going this way. All the girls are going that way. It's all like the Thorazine shuffle. Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. And I am trying to keep a straight face. And I'm going, shit, this is just like my sister. You're going nuts too. And I thought, I wonder if they ever let you out of here. And what they would do, they had about 14 of us nuts in this one place. We all had a drinking problem, though. It's interesting. All of us nuts had a drinking problem. And they would go, the psychiatrist would come by. And the nut house is okay when you're drunk. But once you start drying out, you start to notice things, you know. It doesn't seem so okay. So they would call the shrinks when they would walk through. They would run after them, and they'd go, doctor, doctor, doctor. And the doctor would go like this. And I go, shit, they never talk to you here. So they weren't medicating me, and they weren't talking to me. So I says, I'll go do doctor, doctor, and see if they go like that, I'll die, but I'll do it anyhow. So I went, doctor, doctor. And he says, yes. Scared the shit out of me. But anyhow, he let me go. You know, he says, how are you going to get out of here? I says, a checkbook and a cab. Wanted to know who was president. I could hardly figure that one out, but anyhow, I did escape out of that. But, you know, my my adventures afterwards are really much more exciting. And one of the things that happened to me, you know, if you don't work the steps, and I think, like, I always think of the seventh step, you know, where it's humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Now, when I first got to the seventh step, because I believe these things go on and on and on this lifetime, you know, I don't think you just do them and you're done with them. And the first time, it was like selective removal and not a humbly ask. I can remember it very well. Sitting in a meeting and somebody was talking about a character defect that I identified with. And I says, okay, God, you can remove that one. Isn't that humility? A humbly ask. And I says, you know, that's not really quite a nice way, not even respectful, to talk to somebody. So a few months went by, and I'll tell you what happens. What happened to me is that the character defects, as you sober up and it all lightens up a little bit, I mean, the SOG dwindles, you start not being able to stand all that you used to be able to stand. And that's when suddenly the steps look mighty delicious. When you're still foggy and things are rolling along, and maybe you have a relationship and a job, my goodness, you know, they don't look that interesting or that inviting. But by God, just desog a little bit and roll along a little bit and start getting bored with your own defects and start getting sick of your own crap. And then suddenly they start looking real delicious. And that's when humility really comes in. When you try, you know, I love these people that are, quote, working on a character defect. Because what happens when I work on a character defect is 10 more rise right behind me because of whatever. So I don't do that anymore because I have found that my own bullshit is beyond me. And that is my biggest character defect, is all my own crap, not the rest of the people out there. So you get to the point where you humbly ask. What happened to me when I was 2 years sober is I was not meditating because maybe I hadn't got that far, maybe I wasn't that desperate. But what happened is within a couple of years, I got back all the stuff that I lost, and that's the car, the house, the furniture, all that crap. I've been very good at assimilating piles of crap, you know. I can always do that. I don't hold on to the piles of crap too good, but I had accumulated the right stuff, and my kitties were with me, and we had a nice house and all that crap. And then one day, I just couldn't do anything anymore. 2 years sober, had been going to work like a good human being, and suddenly I was terrified to go to work. I was terrified to do anything. And I used to just lay in bed and shake. And then one day, a brilliant light bulb went on. And I said, whoa, maybe you ought to talk to God about this. And then maybe you ought to listen, Turkey. So that's what I did. It got to the point there and took a couple of months where I could not move out of the house. I could not do anything unless I talked to God and then tried to meditate for a couple of hours. After a couple hours, I had sufficient courage to roll my buns out the door and pretend I was human for the day and go through the act that we all do as though we care about all this good stuff that we're doing. And that's what it took for me. It would take a couple of hours. After a couple hours of meditation, I would have like a 30-second ecstasy, just thrilling, you know, and it'd be worth a couple hours. Plus, you get to move around all day long, and you get to stay sober and stuff like that. And, you know, I have to say that it's like I accumulated the stuff. My kitties, I think they're all alcoholic. All three of them are terrified to take a drink. I got a 23-year-old, a 20-year-old, and a 17-year-old, and they, none of them drink. None of them use anything. They have been raised with AA people around them. I've been, after I was in the program 8 months, I had a one-day drunk. So I've literally been around the program for 11 years. So from little on, they have been around that atmosphere. And like most of the people that come in are AA people. So it's like they really don't want to have anything to do with it. But, you know, my father was a drunk, and I didn't want to grow up to be a drunk. And I did, you know. So I suspect that they will. And the only thing that I can say is that at least they will know where to go, and they will know that there's life after sobriety, that it's not all over. Because my feeling was that when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, that, well, it's all over, and they're all laughing, but they're all miserable, and I'll pretend to have a good time with them because it's the only game in town. And that's, you know, that was literally my attitude. And then after I'd been in the program for a couple of months, someone told me, they said, hey, Sheila, you could be happy in this program. That was an unusual thought. Who could imagine being being happy without a drink? You know, like, how? But I thought, you know, they've never lied to me about anything else. So I suppose it's possible. Then my life has been up and down, but, you know, I have to say that it's like this. It's like, my first 3 months, the whole 3 months, I wanted to drink every minute of every day. Always I wanted to drink. And then at 3 months, I think maybe I surrendered, maybe I took the inventory. I heard somebody say that God shows up at about 3 months, which maybe he does. I don't know. I think he's here all along. Maybe the fog lifts and we can see him. But it's like each little period of time, my life gets better and better and better, and fear keeps diminishing. Hey, I'm not fearless yet. But it keeps diminishing over and over and over. And it's like even this last week, today, the worm is turning. There's always been this big worm inside of me. You know, it's a worm. Ooh, I hate her. But anyhow, it's a real wormy thing. You know, it's afraid of everything and everybody and, ugh, disgusting. And every once in a while it turns a little. And the worm is turning again today. And it's like today, just this very day, I'm at a better freedom level than I've ever had before. I'm in a better spot with myself than I've ever been before. I feel like I can accomplish more than I ever could before. And I'm really on a really good high. And that can end tomorrow. But you know what? All I have to do is try to think of what's to be happy about, and I get it back again. On my 6th AA birthday, I got into Siddha Yoga, which is a meditation master. And that is where my life really accelerated, my spiritual life really accelerated, because I didn't really begin to know about meditation until I learned from him. And so now I figured that was my present from God. I hadn't told anybody it was my birthday. I just sort of, it wasn't that I wasn't sharing it. It's just that I've 6 years, who cares, you know. And that I met him by accident. Well, I shouldn't say by accident. I didn't know that he was a meditation teacher or anything. I just sort of stumbled in there. And I figured that was my gift, you know, my 6th birthday gift from God. And I don't know, it's just really so incredibly fantastic. I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic. And the reason I'm grateful to be an alcoholic is there is no way that I would ever do those steps. There is no way that I would ever look at myself unless I was damn well forced to. There is no way that I'm going to do all those things unless it's really like with the big gun, because I've never done anything. You know, my stick-to-itiveness is really poor, real poor, because I just sort of skim through everything. This is one place where, by God, it's the first time in my entire life that I have had to give it my all. And that's a shock, because I got here at 34, and that was a real shock to, for all those years, to never give it your all. And I will say this, 6 months after I joined this outfit, I never wanted to commit suicide again. And from the time I was about 8 years old until I got to this program, I always thought of suicide. And I think that's, you know, I think that says it right there, that something changed inside, and I ain't killing myself over anybody, you know. And I'm glad to be a drunk, and I'm glad to be here, and I thank you very much for letting me talk tonight. Thank you.